right. Well, what do you think? Let's do it. Okay, we got this.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Here we go. We're saving it for what?
For now. Oh, hello.
Oh, for
now. It's Molly Wood. And we're back with Make Me Smart, the daily edition of our podcast where we try to make today make sense one day at a time. I'm going to start by saying that here it is, Wednesday, what? May 13th. It's been like cold and snowy on the East Coast, and it's so chilly here in California that I just wanted you guys to know I had a hot chocolate in solidarity with you.
Did you really?
Spring has not
sprung. I mean, it was cold
everywhere.
This morning here, but...
Oh, no, it's like totally rainy and blustery and chilly. And I have to say that a hot chocolate made so many things better. Highly recommend.
There you go.
Maybe not for
you.
Do you
have like a scarf and a sweater on too, or what do you do?
I do. Yeah, I have a fuzzy sweater on. And I had to bust out the winter Uggs and go away from the spring scuffs.
All right. Anyhow, moving on. This is, as Ms. Wood said, Wednesday. It is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We take your questions. Thank you, as always, for sending them in. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Put questions in the subject line, and we will add them to our ever-growing list of questions that you all send in. We start with Dan Sanchez today. He says this. We've been hearing a lot about how the unemployment rate is now at a historical level on par with the Great Depression. But I wonder if there's a way to put this into context with the employment landscape of the times. I imagine that more Great Depression families had single-income households that would make the individual employment rate hit harder than it does today. Is there an adjusted employment rate to factor in household unemployment or some other way to more accurately compare the times? The short answer is yes. I would have to dig into the Bureau of Labor Statistics website to check that out. But here's an interesting little factoid from the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell, today. About sort of that topic. And the Fed's coming out with a survey tomorrow, Thursday, that will say 40% of households making less than $40,000 a year had a layoff in the month of March. And the catch here is that this employment situation now is hitting, as we know, the lower end of the income spectrum way, way harder. So I don't care if you're two families or one family, but if you're losing a job making less than $40,000 a year in this economy, that's a huge whack, and that's a huge problem. That's the thing that Powell honestly is concentrating on. So that's my two cents on that answer.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, with all due respect, I'm way less interested in the historical comparison than I am in the actual damage that's happening now, because knowing that it is happening to those who can least afford it, knowing that, you know, there was a big piece in Bloomberg about how it's disproportionately also hitting women, and because it's schools daycares and caregivers and so, I mean, there's no question that it is incomparably bleak, potentially, and that it is, you know, it's so disproportionately exposing the existing income inequality.
Yep.
And I have no idea how that. Even though I started out being like, I don't care, I am kind of curious about what income inequality looked like at the time of the Great Depression. Did the Gilded Age come before or after? I'm sorry that I asked that.
We were just coming out of the Roaring 20s, right? And so, yeah, and so we had that huge income inequality. That's exactly what happened. Same basic thing, different degrees, right?
Care about the comparison. Fascinating.
History matters.
Well, yes. And income inequality never ends well, apparently. Okay. Moving on, Jeff Burke writes, one of the early impacts of the pandemic, as you probably know, is that Airbnb has had a rough time with all the non-travel happening. Mm-hmm. Jeff said, I live in San Diego and have recently spoken to a number of now former Airbnb hosts who have converted their Airbnbs to long-term rentals now that travel has essentially ceased for the foreseeable future. I'm curious if this is part of a bigger trend, if this means the end of Airbnb, especially after seeing them lay off 25% of their workforce.
Yep.
And most importantly, if this will help with California's housing crisis by adding more long-term rentals to the housing supply. And I think this question is fascinating. Yep. So early on, like in March... Our assistant producer on the tech show, Jesus Alvarado, he's so funny. He keeps refers to every month as March, and it's hysterical. He's like, here on March 74th, here on March 197th. It's pretty awesome. Anyway, back in the original March, someone put a map on Twitter and basically said, I have correlated places where that used to be Airbnb heavy, right? Like places that had a lot of tourism travel, for example. And I've gone and I've looked at their Craigslist long-term housing listings, houses that are for rent. And it is clear from the data that a lot of housing stock that had previously been short-term rentals is now coming online. And so we're probably going to come out of this with, in fact, this actual data to show how much housing stock Airbnb really maybe did remove from the rental market. And it's going to be a lot harder should that company return to like the dominance that it had before. Because honestly, if people convert those rentals into long-term rentals,
right,
they're going to have leases, right? They're not going to be able to like boot people and go back to putting them on Airbnb. So their supply may be lower in the long term. And the argument that they didn't significantly reduce housing supply might be a heck of a lot harder to make when there are hard numbers.
Do you think, as Jeff said in the question, do you think it means the end of Airbnb? Question mark.
I don't. I mean, I think Airbnb's own stock, like I said, could be a problem depending on how long people can afford to keep rental properties empty. But listen, like, I would much rather rent a house with me and my family for the next 2 years than be in a hotel with tons of other people in a lobby and an elevator. Like everybody's seen those videos of where you put the black light on the hotel and you see all the things. Remember that scene in The Office where they're like, God, I hope that's blood. I mean, I don't consider hotels to be particularly clean generally. I'm not disparaging anybody's individual hotel here, but like I would much rather rent an Airbnb than hotels. And I think that's the bet they're making on the long term too. That's why they raised $2 billion in loans, like fairly high interest loans. And to be honest, just to back it up, I suspect that those private equity investments of $1 billion a piece are a big reason why they laid off 25% of their workforce too. I'm sure that that was part of the deal.
Yeah. Yeah. They were getting squeezed for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I think housing supply will become an Airbnb problem, but I suspect that's how people are going to want a vacation in the future.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's my guess.
Okay, yesterday on the big show, the Tuesday show, talked to Stephanie Kelton about modern monetary theory. Lots of questions came in on that topic. Here is one from Jeff Lum. He writes, like Molly, my mind was blown by Stephanie Kelton's view of the government deficit as a surplus in the economy. I've always understood that the money is created through loans on the bond market, and that foreign entities like China own those bonds and therefore have leverage through ownership of that debt. Is there a risk that those entities could influence our policies because they own our debt? So there's like three things wrapped up in there. Number one, money is created. So money is created, modern monetary theory or conventional old capitalism aside, money is created by the Federal Reserve, as Stephanie Kelton said, using its special keyboard that Jay Powell has in his office to create reserve credits, right? That's how the Fed adds to the money supply. It creates them on its computer, and then it takes collateral and lends that money out to big institutions who then lend it through the economy. So that's issue number one that we have to clear up, right? The government borrowing money or issuing debt is not creating money. What happens is when Congress passes a law that says we're going to spend $11 gajillion on the PPP, it has to fund that, and it sells government debt. It sells bonds and borrows the money from China and Japan and the Social Security Trust Fund and all those places. So that's point number two. Mm-hmm. Point number three is that, yes, China holds $1 trillion worth of American debt. And would they, in theory, have leverage on us? Yes. But if they go and just sell all that on the market, then their economy suffers as well because they are so heavily invested in our economy and vice versa. It's all a circular thing, right? So you can't really do damage to somebody else at scale without damaging yourself. And that's the answer to that question.
It's a Rouboros, the snake that eats its own head.
But also very separate. Good word.
I love that one. I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Separate though from, and this is important, from the idea that with modern monetary theory, you can create the amount of money that you need to invest in economically advantageous activity. And that's not, so I want to just make sure that Jeff, we clarify that we're not talking about money. We're not talking about loans in the bond market and foreign entities. We're talking about the keyboard money.
Mm-hmm.
I put a bunch of funny letters in there.
That's right.
Keyboard money.
Yeah.
All right. Our last question comes from Dwayne Needham, And Kai, I think this is probably in reference to the piece you did on ETFs on Marketplace yesterday, day, March 53rd.
Yeah, yes, I think. They're all the same.
Is the question, Dwayne says, is the Federal Reserve's buying of ETFs just TARP 2.0? With so many businesses and industries headed toward Chapter 11 bankruptcies, the moral hazard of this particular type of Fed bailout seems obvious, writes Dwayne. I know that big sigh. There's a lot to explain here. Remind us what TARP. TARP was the big bailout during the financial crisis.
TARP was the giant bailout during the financial crisis, authorized at $700 billion. They spent about $400 billion. Part of that was bank recapitalization and all kinds of other stuff. We're getting back into the kind of money here. That was congressional money, right? Congress authorized us to borrow $700 billion so that we could put it back into the economy and stop the bleeding. The Federal Reserve's buying of ETFs is keyboard money. Okay? That's Jay Powell's private – there you go. It's Jay Powell's private keyboard. And so just to refresh, what they did was the Federal Reserve, it announced it a number of weeks ago and it started doing it yesterday, is going to, for the very first time, instead of investing in things like – let me rephrase that. Instead of taking as collateral things like U.S. Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities – the Fed is now going to invest in exchange-traded funds, which are funds of things that trade on the stock market like stocks. In this particular case, ETFs composed of corporate bonds. And it's doing that because early in this crisis, corporations had a really tough time selling their bonds, that is to say, raising capital. And if they couldn't raise capital, then they couldn't make investments, pay their people, do business, all of those kinds of things. So this is a big deal. But it is separate and apart from the TARP. Different deal. Mm-hmm. Now, is there moral hazard? Possibly, but as Tim Geithner, who was the president of the New York Fed, said during an interview I did with him a number of years ago about the financial crisis, he said, look, the temptation is to let the entire thing burn down. That is not the responsible thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is not a satisfactory answer if you want to see things burn down.
It isn't. Right. It really isn't. Well, it's not a satisfactory answer when you have the Fed taking these actions that are probably right. I mean, you and I had this conversation when we were talking about the stock market being so disconnected from reality.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, but don't we kind of want it to be? Because we don't want everything to be on fire. I think the moral hazard comes in when you see the Fed taking all these actions and then standing up there and just somewhat sort of impotently saying, P.S. Congress, you are also going to have to get out of your coma and keep investing to keep the economy going. And so there is starting to be – I read this really interesting piece, actually. I put it in here for later reading. But Chamath Palihapitiya, who's this billionaire investor, ran a VC firm called Social Capital – basically said that the more of these moves the Fed does, the more the economy does become disconnected from the stock and bond market. And in fact, the Fed almost obfuscates, is the word that he used, how bad this is. And that he says asset inflation does not solve income disparity. And that we are not correspondingly giving people enough money to have a real economic recovery. We're just like letting rich people get richer.
Yeah. So two things. One, the Fed doesn't give people money, right? That's not what the Fed does. Number two, income inequality is not the problem that the Fed is trying to solve. It is literally not the Fed's job. It is literally not the Fed's job. So what else can Jay Powell do except stand up as he did again today and say, hey, you blankety blanks in Congress, what in the blazes are you people doing? That's all he can do.
I agree. I mean, I think people like Chamath are starting to argue like, let it, on some level, let it burn, or not necessarily let it
burn, but
let, like if you're buying corporate debt ETF, are you helping the company keep people on the payroll, or are you helping investors, most of whom are not mainstream, make more money? That's his argument.
Yeah, well, see, it's really tough to parse that out, and you sort of can't do one without doing the other.
Yep.
And the idea that the Fed should stand by as this,
pension funds are part of the market. So yeah, like I'm not even arguing you can separate, but I do think it is It is provocative. Clearly, I can tell by your tone. You have been provoked.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just irritated because, hey, it's the end of a long day of, you know, the 93rd of March or whatever. But look, yeah. I understand the intention of saying, listen, we have to help everybody. But the idea that the people whose job it is not to let the economy burn down should stand there and let the economy burn down, it is, I don't understand that.
Yep.
Because then everybody gets hurt, and we have a depression that lasts for a decade.
Yeah. I mean, hey, man, I actually agree with you. Like, I do think the last thing you want is for literally everything to be on fire. I agree.
Right.
But I think that you are going to start to see, and this is what Neil Irwin was warning about in the piece that we alluded to a mm-hmm. week or so ago. Mm-hmm. Or a year ago, I don't know, about how these conversations about moral hazard kind of make everything worse. That the more we yep. descend into that, the less actual work gets done. Nobody's yep. sitting here saying they can solve it. But those are the questions that are starting to be asked. Just like yours.
Just like
everyone, me. That's it. That's it for today's round. Woo!
We're done. My goodness. Back to tomorrow, another daily little thing. We'll be back in format here. It's me and Molly doing a news thing and then a thing to make us smile, which really we should have had today because clearly I got a little not smiling. Make me smart at marketplace.org, subject line questions. And there we are.
And that's it.
There we go.
Bear poked. Sorry, man. I tried the poop boop today. That's my make me smile. The poop boop works like a charm.
Oh, yeah. And did it work? Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
It was incredible. I was like, oh my God, you guys are geniuses. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and our senior producer is Jody Becker. Ben Hethcote is our video producer. Ethan Peretz is our video intern. Thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips.
Today's show was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And there we go.
And there we go.
Boom.
Tony said he tried the poop boop too. We should trademark this thing. Except we can't because it was a crowdsourced solution.
I'd probably try. You could sell a bag that had poop boop on it, right? So you're charging for the bag, not for the intellectual property.
That's adorable.
Oh, snap. Can you say marketplace
poop
fundraiser?
Poop bags?
Thank you.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.